Okay, so, hey, nice to see so many people. I was writing this talk right up to the last minute, actually. I kind of knew I was a last minuter. I didn't know I was quite such a last minuter. Which I think says something about my relationship to the material, but I guess that'll come out as we go along. I was also reading, at least yesterday when I started doing the talk, reading the blurb you've probably seen in the programme, which might be the reason you're here. And I thought, good grief, who on earth wrote this? Drawing on his 5 years of homeless wandering, Lokabandhu argues that spiritual abundance and material simplicity go hand in hand. And maybe I wrote that at some point. I don't know. Anyway, it took quite a struggle to sort of, you know, engage with it, to write the talk about it. But we'll see how we get on. It's quite odd giving a talk, because here I have no idea who most of the people are. So it's not like talking to a person where you get into a dialogue and you kind of learn about each other as you go. You know, I'm talking this whole room full of folk, and I can see a few friendly faces dotted about, but a whole bunch of people, I don't know who they are. But I think that is the nature of Witherfield. It's a place where many people with many philosophies and paths and perspectives meet, which is part of its kind of richness, but I can't take anything very particular for granted in speaking to you. So again, we'll see how we get on. And I don't know how the timing goes in here, but it'd be great to have some time at the end for dialogue. There's plenty of time. Okay, great. So we do have, I'm sure, many paths and perspectives and philosophies, you know, different ones between us. But we also have certain kind of very fundamental things completely in common, I'm sure. I don't know if you came to the ritual, the opening ritual on Wednesday evening, where they called in the five directions with the five elements and the five Buddhas. But each of the Buddhas had a wisdom. And two of them I particularly love. There's the wisdom of discrimination and the wisdom of equality. So the wisdom of discrimination is where every single being is unique and different. Completely different. You and you and you, completely different. No one like you anywhere in the world, or you or you. Which is true, absolutely true. But the wisdom of equality is where we are all in the same boat. Absolutely all in the same boat. It doesn't matter if you're old or young, black, white, male, female, this, that, whatever, whatever. We're all equal from a certain point of view. And that's equally true. And I think one of these equalising realities is that we're all on some kind of journey through life. I mean, we're all alive. That's the first thing. And we are all at some point on our journey through life to death. That's true, I think, for all of us. If you dispute it, then lucky you, or unlucky you, depending on your view of immortality. Yeah, but I think if you reflect on that, it just begs the question, how to live? Here we are, somewhere in the middle of our life, how to live? I remember being on a retreat, and we did this very simple but quite powerful ritual where we were each given a candle, one of those fairly tall, thin candles, and we were invited to break the candle at some point between the top and the bottom, kind of reflecting, dividing into two halves, to reflect how far we thought we were on our journey through life. You know, roughly halfway in the middle, if you're lucky, break it there. Quite young, break it there. You know, over 70, break it here. And then that was the first quite sobering moment. And then as we did our reflection or whatever it was, we all lit our candles, the bit that was left, so to speak, and they were all burning down slowly as the evening went on. So there we were, you know, watching our lives tick away. So that is true, you know, it is true. So we're on this kind of journey together. We're all on the journey, yeah, through life to death. And in a bit, I'd like us to reflect, do a kind of little meditation, and maybe even share some of it, as to, you know, what we think might cause us regrets when we get to that final moment, at some point in the future, of death. you know, what might cause us regrets. So I'll mention that now, but we'll get there in a bit. Yeah. I wanted to start off a little bit more autobiographically, just because this blurb here that somebody wrote refers to it. 5 years of homeless wandering, which is true, but it's a bit more complicated than that. I guess life always is. And it caused me some trouble writing this talk, because, yes, I did have 5 years homeless wandering, and they were a very rich time, actually. But they were also a very long time ago, so I'm not doing that at the moment. So my life at the moment is quite different. So I'll say a little bit about, you know, my journey. And I kind of felt, actually, writing this talk, I had to be talking to myself as much as you guys about material simplicity, spiritual abundance, and so on and so on. But luckily, one of the other wisdoms of the 5 Buddha wisdoms is the mirror-like wisdom, which kind of reflects it all back at you. So that's great. We can have that in the room too. Whatever I say can be reflected back to me. So yeah, when I was quite a bit younger, I mean pushing 30 years ago now, I was just ordained, and kind of had a couple of years being ordained, and was feeling kind of restless, like I wanted to spread my wings, go out, have adventures, be tested, you know, prove myself, make a mark, all that kind of young man stuff. And I'd been living at that time in a community in London, inner city London, for a long time. And while I'd been there, the community got more established and more kind of routinized. And in my mind, at least, it kind of lost something. More and more of our discussions were about what sort of carpet to fit, rather than, you know, enlightenment and how to get there. So I was feeling cramped anyway. I remember I used to go on bus journeys and train journeys and look out of the window with this longing at the countryside flying by. And I think, wow, I could walk down that path. And could I camp in those trees and look at that sky? A real kind of yearning to be out there. And it was also the time, I imagine some of us remember it, of massive road protest camps around England. And all these people at Newbury, Pollock in Glasgow, actually in Leytonstone in London, were digging into camps and tunnels and things to stop roads being built. And they were on the news quite a bit. And I was aware of them, and they just looked from a distance like really heroic types. We did not talk about fitted carpets. But they were willing to really, you know, put their bodies on the line for, you know, for something meaningful. And I wanted to kind of go and see them, meet them. So that led me to leave London and go off on this kind of homeless wandering. But the first time I just did it for a year, because I had a kind of similar parallel craving as this young man to be an apprentice to somebody older and wiser. So I kind of did two things at once. I sort of left my job and went off wandering, and I committed to being an apprentice, travelling secretary of another member of our order, much sort of more senior experience than me. So after a year, I kind of felt I had to go back to work and, you know, work for him, which I did. But that yearning didn't go away. So after 5 years apprenticeship, I left that as well and went back to do 5 years homeless wandering, which I really loved. I loved it, actually. And it was 5 years, part of Butterfield, and, yeah, the definition for me... Oh, thank you. The definition of homelessness for me was I did not have a front door key in my pocket, which meant, and the key symbolises there's a door somewhere in the planet that you've got the right to go in and close the door and be safe and nobody else can come in, and, you know, that's your home and your kind of refuge. And if you don't have a key in your pocket, you know, there's actually nowhere you can definitely go into. So you're kind of alone or out there in some way. Yeah. I did that. Fast forwarding a bit, a few years later, I had another period of home, not quite homelessness, but living in a horse box in a field. So the first phase I call my adventurer phase. The second phase was like a hermit. I just wanted to withdraw and just live completely alone, completely isolated, just in a field with no electricity, no mobile, no internet, no computers, just me alone in a field. I had a strong yearning to be a hermit, and I was lucky enough to find a field and a horse box in Glastonbury, and I did it. But that also was kind of not quite undermined, but balanced by a kind of parallel yearning at the same time of a lover. You know, this, I just started a new relationship, so I didn't want to kind of kiss it all goodbye. So I sort of being a hermit and trying to be a lover at the same time. And I'm sure she could tell you all sorts of stories, but she's not here, so she won't. And actually, there was a third phase, which is almost going on now, where I've got the same split. The lovers turned into family life. So we've bought a house together and we're living together, family life. She's got a little son. But I've been spending a lot of time away from Glastonbury in Southampton as a builder, building a Buddhist centre, converting our first pub into a Buddhist centre. A lovely thing to do. But there, I have nothing apart from a bed, you know, clothes to work in, and a mobile phone. So that's complete sort of stripped down life. Back home is family chaos. Southampton half the time is it's a kind of monkish existence. Get up, put on these simple clothes, go to work, go to bed. Get up, put on simple clothes, go to work, go to bed. So anyway, that's a little bit of background. But the first thing, leaving home to go wandering, was very much inspired by the Buddha. I really had this feeling that the Buddha left home. He left a palace, actually. I just left a fire station in inner city London, where the community was. The Buddha left home and went wandering for the whole of the rest of his life, 40 years, and just walked about and just slept under trees and met people at random, but was able to communicate and had a real deep effect on them. And I wanted to kind of... Well, that spoke to me very strongly, just to be sort of so free and wandering and... But somehow... have such abundance that your simple meetings with people could have a real effect on them. That really spoke to me. So I was very inspired by the Buddha and his teaching. Mixed in with this young man's thirst for adventure and challenge and ordeal and so on. But actually the first phase, I will say, it was this time of road protesters, and I kind of used it to wander about but to visit every single alternative community I could come across in Britain in 1995, it was. And I visited about 50 different places. I had a whole list of the things. Some were quite settled and established, and some were just tree houses. But about half the way through the year, the little Butterfield team of the time was talking, and we thought, hey, let's do a festival, which we hadn't thought of before, but we'd been going a few years. We thought, let's do a festival. And I suddenly realised I could invite all these 50 communities I'd been to visit to the festival. So we did. And it really kind of kick-started the first festival with this really rich mixture of Buddhists and all sorts of other types, which I think has continued ever since, actually. So I feel happy about that. It's like the seed. It was seeded by that wandering. Anyway... So what I'd like to do now is kind of reflection on spiritual qualities or spiritual abundance, or almost like what we want from life. So I've talked about us being on a journey through life, and it'll end at some point, who knows when, with death. And if we're lucky, we'll have a kind of, you know, clear moment at that time, you know, of reflecting. And I just want to ask the question to all of us, what might cause us regrets if we hadn't done more of this or less of that when we get to that time? Because that'll say something about the type of life we want to lead. So a little meditation, maybe, and then any kind of suggestions from the audience. Yeah, what kind of what would cause us regrets when we get to death? Just a moment or so, you know, first thought, best thought. What might you wish you'd done differently? Suggestions? Come on, speak loud and clear.
No.
Speak loud and clear.
Not listening to your soul.
Not listening to your soul.
Yeah,
yeah, thank you.
Listen to your heart, not your head, but not my soul.
Okay, yeah. Sure, thank you. Someone else had their hand up at the back.
Not planning my funeral.
Not planning your funeral?
Not putting money aside to pay for it.
Okay, yeah, sure. Thank you. Others?
Not giving full rein to my creativity.
Oh, yeah, sure. You're an artist, I know.
Yes, but I sort of mean it in the fullest possible sense of, acting without being filtered by convention or self-limiting.
Okay,
ideas.
Yeah, sure.
Being lazy.
Okay. Buddhism's got great definitions of laziness. Mm-hmm. One is making money and defeating enemies is lazy. But one is the pleasure of lying down and not getting up. Anyway, being lazy, yeah.
Not decluttering.
Okay. There you go. Not decluttering.
Not having kids.
Not having kids. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Couple more. Yeah. Go on.
Not healing family wounds.
Sure, yeah, I agree.
It's a bit mundane, but not travelling and feeling fit, and not ever feeling the full potential of my human body.
Yeah.
Not being braver,
yeah.
It's not a knot, but I'd regret spending too much time doing things that I'm doing just because people said that I should.
Being conventional.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, being conventional.
And time ticks away. Mm. Yeah.
Not prioritising spiritual
life, yeah. Should be a success for your parents. Okay. I think it's a good reflection. I think one for me is not resolving disharmonies, because it's, you know, it takes effort to resolve a disharmony. It's easy just to leave it, the little broken relationship out there. Yeah, I think, looking at it positively, I want to die with a sense that I've done my best. You know, I've made my best efforts. I've not frittered away time and energy. I think I also want to die just with a sense of inner confidence to face whatever comes next. I have no idea what comes next. You know, none of us know what comes next. But you want to die with a sense of confidence that you're ready for it, with those resources, whatever they are, to face it. So that's a kind of thought experiment, you know, a little reflection we've done. But it's not hypothetical, because actually we are on a journey through life, and actually it is going to come to an end at some point. And I did notice Butterfield is unusually well prepared for next year, mm-hmm. and the whole theme for next year, Butterfield 2018, is the dance of life and death. So we're a little bit ahead of the curve in here. But we've got a whole year to think about it next year. Actually, two classic reflections in Buddhism, they're called the mind-turning reflections, I think, are that, first of all, death is certain. You can just reflect on that until it really goes in. Death is certain. And another one is that the time of death is uncertain. So they're both true. The time of death is uncertain. So the time to start cultivating the things we've mentioned, whatever they might be for you, is now. Because the time of death is uncertain. Whether it's travelling and keeping fit, or resolving disharmonies, or creativity, or whatever. So that all comes under the heading, I would say, of spiritual abundance. That's going to be part of spiritual abundance for us. For me, it's also, and it's about how we live our life. For me, spiritual abundance is also about kind of cultivating certain qualities in the present, where we can just be more fully alive in the present, more fully present, if you like, in the present. And in particular, having a capacity for wonder in the present, of appreciation for beauty in the present, the capacity to really pay attention to what's going on in the present, pay attention to yourself, you know, your actual reality at this moment, and attention to others, rather than just superficially, you know, taking everything for granted. I think for me, spiritual abundance is very much about a sense of confidence. You kind of have what you need. Your needs are met. You're kind of resourced. And that means you're ready to kind of go forward into the future, whatever the future is, whether it's just the next moment or the next life, if you believe in that. It also means you're ready to act. You've kind of got that confidence or capacity to act. And I think the festival, kind of right here and now, is just full of opportunities to take pleasure, you know, in the beauty of it and the wonder of it and the magic of it and the strangeness of it. You know, to kind of fully pay attention to what's going on. It's an unusual bunch of people doing unusual things, you know, and we're right in the middle of it. It's a fabulous opportunity. But what I want to talk about now is the relationship, whatever it might be, between material simplicity and spiritual abundance. Hopefully we agree that some sort of spiritual abundance might mean slightly different things for all of us, is a good thing. You know, it's almost what makes life worth living. But the question arises, how best to cultivate it? You know, what conditions do we need to cultivate spiritual abundance? And how does material simplicity come into that? So the first thing is that we have a whole bunch of healthy human needs. You know, we're alive, we need food, we need shelter, we need warmth, we need security. That's completely necessary. They're material needs, most of them, and they're necessary. Nothing wrong with that. But simplicity, it's the kind of art of meeting those needs as quickly or efficiently or elegantly as possible, and as having as little impact on the rest of the planet as possible while you meet them. So you need food, but how do you get your food? Does it have to be flown in from New Zealand or somewhere? You need shelter, but does it need to cost £500,000 and give you a mortgage for life? You need warmth, you know, but does it have to be nuclear power? And so on and so on. So how to meet those needs? I put voluntary simplicity in the blurb, or somebody did, because unless it's voluntary, you know, we're talking more about poverty, and nobody wants to practice poverty, but voluntary simplicity has got a very different feel about it. So it's got to be a choice. It's got to be something that we choose to do, because we want to meet those needs, you know, as kind of quickly and efficiently and elegantly and non-violently as possible. But I firmly believe we live in a society of extraordinary affluence and abundance, where all those things, or most of them, are oozing out of our economy. I mean, if you need clothes, you just go to a charity shop. It's like we've produced enough clothes for a lifetime. So yeah, there's many, many choices we have. I particularly love a little saying by William Morris, who designed all that fancy wallpaper, who I believe said, "Have nothing in your houses except what you know to be useful or believe to be beautiful." Very nice saying. It's like you know it's useful, great, you need it, or you believe it's beautiful and you want it. That's a very nice yardstick to have for me. But I said at the beginning, I feel a bit conflicted or compromised giving the talk, because at the moment I have a lot of stuff in the house I live in which is not useful or beautiful. And it kind of comes from this family life thing and a partner, and we've just moved house. And when you move house, all your friends and relations take the opportunity to give you all the things in their cupboards that they really don't want. And they see an opportunity and they get in their car and drive it over. And we have not got rid of it yet. So we're working on it. Yeah. And my partner, I mean, I do love a certain minimalism, but my partner, who I love dearly, has one of those rich, creative, you know, abundant sort of approaches to stuff. I'm sure you know the sort. Yeah. Anyway, don't tell her. Anyway, so meeting our needs, meeting our healthy human needs is perfectly what we need to do, but we can meet them as elegantly and efficiently as possible. And the purpose of that, I would say, is to create space in our lives for more. To create more time in our lives, to create more energy in our lives, and more kind of headspace in our lives, which we can use for other things, rather than just getting by, rather than just living, staying alive. Which leads, obviously, into the whole territory of the spiritual life, and what's that about? But I just want to say, a lot of people talk about the spiritual life, the simple life. But when I was travelling about homeless, I came to realise it's a somewhat ambiguous phrase. So for a lot of people, their vision is to lead a simple life. But what they often mean is an elemental life. They've got a fantasy of leaving the city and going into the country and chopping wood and carrying water and, you know, and living out of doors. And I would say that is not the simple life, that's the elemental life. You're much closer to the raw elements. But in that kind of life, you see it here in Butterfield, it can take you half an hour to make a cup of tea, because you need to get the wood and chop it up and make sure it's dry and there's some kindling and light the fire and get it going and down to the stream and get the water, and it takes forever. So it's elemental and it's great and it's very attractive and it's part of our human nature, but it's not quite simple in the sense of convenient. So if you want a simple, convenient life, that's different. And I would say modern living in a flat with double glazing and central heating, it's pretty much as convenient as humanity has yet made it, because you can just do all that stuff in no time at all. You warm up your dinner in the microwave in 30 seconds. So the elemental life is one thing, and the convenient life is another. But often they're both talked about as simple. And then actually the low impact life is another thing, because you can do those two things and actually still have quite a footprint on the planet. So some people live in the depths of the country and it's very elemental and beautiful, but they need a 4x4 to go shopping to buy, you know, the food. So it's kind of slightly, you've got to get the language right. I would say all three are great. You know, the low impact life and the convenient life and the elemental life are all good, but they're slightly different things. Butterfield, I think, specialises in the elemental life. You come with Butterfield and you're a bit closer to the elements than back home. Yeah, and I do personally have a love of small spaces. I recommend small spaces. I lived in Birmingham in a shed made of doors, and I lived in my hermit phase in a horse box in the field. And they're both tiny, and it makes you very precise. It's like one thing in, one thing out. There is no room for clutter. So when I was preparing for travelling about or living in a shed and stuff, you have to go through a process. And Buddhism speaks a lot about going forth. So the Buddha left home. You know, he had a process of leaving home, going forth. When I left the community in London or in Birmingham to go homeless, there was a process. Because just when you stand still, you accumulate all kinds of stuff. Either bits and pieces of paper or clothes or things people give you or whatever. And I had to go through quite a process of whittling it down further and further and further. And one thing I realised, I really recommend, is you have to do it with a lot of sensitivity to yourself. Because you've accumulated this stuff, and it's almost like part of you. All this clutter, somebody mentioned decluttering, it's part of you. It's like a shell. It's like your clothes. You've surrounded yourself with it. And it might be getting in the way, and you've outgrown it, but you've got to get rid of it sensitively. So I remember having a period of about 6 months in Birmingham, where every morning, after meditation, before breakfast, I'd review my possessions. And I discovered, to my surprise, every day I could let go of something else, which I couldn't the previous day. I was just ready to drop this shirt, or give away these books, or, you know, whatever it was. And it was very organic, and I was glad I did it that way. Otherwise, I would have done it out of willfulness, where you think, right, I'm going to be a hero. Just burn the lot. And then you wake up in a week's time and you deeply regret having done all that. So going forth has to be a process sensitive to you as you go through it. And there's a tension there, because a little bit of attachment and a little bit of desire to go forth. So you just kind of live in that tension, pushing yourself a little bit each day, or challenging yourself a little bit each day. I remember another example. I went on a retreat up a Spanish mountain. We have a retreat centre up in Spain, the mountains. Very, very elemental place. They needed at least two 4x4s to bring the food in. So I went on a retreat there, and the shrine room was just this bare concrete floor and pretty hard. So the first day I turned up for meditation with a whole bunch of stuff, like a mat and little cushions for my knees and lots of things to sit on and a blanket and like a whole nest to kind of sit on and be comfortable. And it was ridiculous because it was never quite right and it slipped out here and there. And as the retreat went on, I was aware of this collection of stuff getting simpler and simpler, till at the end I literally arrived in the shrine room with a sleeping bag stuffed in its case as an instant meditation cushion, and that was it. I realised you can sit on the concrete floor perfectly happily if you've got your posture right, and then there's your cushion and it's perfect. It's a lovely sense of simplifying down. So the simple life, for me at least, is to open up space. Time, space, energy space, head space, which you can use, you know, to kind of go further in your spiritual life or your creative life or whatever. I think it does one other thing, which I want to mention, which is, I think a simple life, especially in the sense of a low-impact life, is a kind of is an ethical life, where your conscience becomes clearer. You know you're meeting your needs, and you know you're meeting your healthy human needs in the most simple, low-impact way possible. And you know you're not unnecessarily, you know, consuming or impacting or damaging or whatever. So I think the simple life lived properly leads to a clear conscience. And for Buddhism, that's almost the beginning of the spiritual path. So Buddhism talks about the spiritual path in lots of different ways, but the one that I like most is the one the Buddha used again and again as he was entering his final months. He was on a farewell tour, which ended with his death. And he went around and around and around his followers, and he just spoke about his whole path as being ethics, meditation, wisdom. He said it again and again, ethics, meditation, wisdom. And ethics, for me, for him, I think, is that you have, there's nothing with which you can reproach yourself. You know you've done your best. You've got a clear conscience. And that's the foundation in Buddhism for having a clear mind. A clear conscience leads to a clear mind. And then meditation is all about having a certain space in your mind and a certain kind of clarity in your mind, just to pay attention that bit more fully. And particularly attention with love, a kind of loving attention. And then those two, ethics and meditation, for Buddhism, are the kind of foundation for wisdom. Now, wisdom's like a big word, sounds a bit grand, but you can call it insight, which is simply sight, seeing into things as they really are. And things as they really are all around us. The grass is growing, the sun shines, people are people, you know, here's all the things. But if you're able to see them clearly enough, that's insight. You see their kind of true, deeper nature. And that is the spiritual life for Buddhism, ethics, meditation and wisdom. What you see is that things are impermanent, things arise in dependence on conditions, and they pass away when the conditions change. Things are sort of unstable or unreliable in a way, and so on and so on. But that leads to a kind of freedom. You're not caught up in all that. You've seen through it in a way. You've seen its true nature. So ethics, meditation, and wisdom, I think, lead to freedom. And that leads also to what a lovely phrase in Buddhism, spontaneous compassionate activity. Spontaneous compassionate activity. It's where you sorted yourself out, you've got all this energy left over, you've met your needs and so on, and you just give yourself to spontaneous compassionate activity, which could be anything. It's spontaneous, hey. But it's not... nobody tells you what to do, but it's compassionate. It's not you getting more, more, more for me, me, me. It's activity for the benefit of the world. If you see a need, you just act, you meet it. If you see a person who needs something, you go out to them. And I think when you look at this whole kind of sequence together, ethics, meditation, wisdom, freedom, spontaneous, compassionate activity, there's a kind of movement there from something that starts off as a bit of a discipline. You know, you're consciously making a bit of an effort to go forth and let go of things, to something that's a whole new way of being. And it's part of you, it's a way of being. It's not a discipline at all. And that's kind of the Buddhist path. You do need to take on a certain discipline. You are confronting your habits, but you're trying to create new habits, and then beyond new habits, you're trying to create a new way of being, which is not habitual, it's spontaneous. So, time to finish, I think. I just want to mention three things very, very quickly, which I hope are sort of touchstones you might like to take away if you're interested in making this journey, you know, from material stuff to material simplicity to spiritual abundance. So the first thing is, the word I've written down is sustainability. It's got to work for you. If you're too willful, or you're not taking yourself into account enough, you'll bounce back. You'll have a big reaction. You will go completely the opposite direction and go on a whole shopping binge. So giving things up, going forth, simplifying is very important, but do it sensitively and organically so it is sustainable for you. Anything else I'd class as a kind of violence, really, to yourself. One bit of you is telling another bit of you it's bad and you've got to stop it. So just be really sensitive to yourself. And I like this idea of a daily review, and gradually things drop away. The second thing is, this is a process that never ends. So you might think, you know, if I get down to 6 pairs of shoes, I've done it. But actually there's always further to go. You could have 5 pairs of shoes. And then beyond 5, 4. So always look for the next step. Now, wherever you are, what's the next step you want to take? I realised that very clearly in Butterfield a few years ago, where we had a debate in the festival about drugs. So there's always a bit of tension in Butterfield about drugs. Some people come here and, you know, they're a bit addicted to drugs, alcohol or whatever, and some people not in the slightest. So then there can be tension between the people who are just not interested and the people who are a bit addicted, and they do indulge a bit. But what I realised is the appropriate demand is to ask everybody to take the next step. So if you're teetotal and clean and this and that, great, but what's the next step for you into a kind of simple ethical life? But if you're really struggling with something, some kind of addiction, the next step for you will be very different. So an example for me is I went vegetarian many, many years ago, 30 years ago or something, great. Then I kind of ticked that box, I'd done it, sorted out my diet. But slowly, slowly, this realisation grew up in me that there was further to go and I was actually being lazy. Somebody mentioned laziness. And the whole next step for me was veganism, which I wasn't taking because I love my chocolate. I love my chocolate. And cheese, actually. So, you know, I was vegetarian, lovely, but I was not taking any kind of next step. But eventually an order member in Birmingham wrote this very powerful essay on veganism, and I just realised I had to do something. I was being lazy. So I took a next step to veganism. Great. So anyway, always look for the next step. Proceed sustainably, but look for the next step. Then the third thing is, you know, as time and space opens up in your life, just ask yourself, you know, how do I want to use this precious opportunity? So Buddhism speaks about precious opportunity. Life is a precious opportunity. Every moment is a precious opportunity. Death is certain. The time of death is uncertain. You know, this is the moment to choose wisely how to live. So just kind of always look for the kind of how to go a bit deeper. That might be deeper in your relationships, your communication. It might be deeper in your work, you know, how to create value in your work. It might be deeper in your meditation, how to avoid all those daydreams and fantasies and just go a bit deeper. You know, there's always a direct, you can take a choice of distraction or depth. So life is short, you know, choose depth. So I just want to finish with a little poem, actually, which says all this in a great deal fewer words. It's by a Tibetan Buddhist called Tsongkhapa, and I'm sure a lot of you know it because it's a verse we love to use in Butterfield and Tiratna. But I'll just finish with this little poem. Yeah. So, the human body, at peace with itself, is more precious than the rarest gem. Cherish your body. It is yours this one time only. The human form is one with difficulty. It is easy to lose. All worldly things are brief, like lightning in the sky. This life you must know as the tiny splash of a raindrop, a thing of beauty that disappears even as it comes into being. Therefore, set your goal and make use of every day and night to achieve it. Thank you.